much. Thank you. I appreciate it. Have a nice weekend.
You too.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. McCall and Mr. Chandoval, you're both on the phone, correct?
Yes, this is Mr. McCall.
Yes, Chairman, this is Mr. Chandoval. I was also told to inform the court that Ann Lloyd, an assistant commonwealth attorney, the City of Richmond, CA's office, may also be on the call. The court may already be aware of that, but I want to make that note.
I am on the call. Yes. Okay, thank you. All right, well, counsel, you each will have 15 minutes. Mr. McCall, if you want to reserve any time for rebuttal out of that 15 minutes, let me know up front, and I'll be keeping track of the time. And the same request to both of you, that you give us, you pause every once in a while, so if we have any questions, we can ask them. So, Mr. McCall, do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, please, if I could reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, I'll let you know when your time is up on your primary argument. You can proceed.
Thank you.
Whenever you're ready.
Thank you. This is Leonard McCall. Hello, everyone. I represent Mr. Rashad Hartridge in this petition, Rashad Hartridge versus the Commonwealth of Virginia. Basically, we're here today in regards to Batson Challenge. It's our position that the trial court in this particular matter erred when the trial court denied Mr. Hartridge's Batson Challenge to four jurors being struck based on their race. I will tell the court that two of the jurors that were initially struck, the defense had stipulated and submitted to those individuals being struck for racial neutral reasons. However, that left two remaining jurors. The Commonwealth stated that their reasoning for striking those remaining two jurors was based on individuals being residents of high crime areas. So with that being said, it looks like we're really concentrating on the third prong of a Batson challenge, and whether or not the Commonwealth's striking of the last two particular jurors were pretextual. From the beginning, the defense has stated that the Commonwealth's striking of the African-American jurors in this particular case were a systematic approach to targeting African-Americans. We look to guidance from the Batson case, and also guidance from the Buck case at the Court of Appeals level, where it was ruled that the Commonwealth's reasoning for striking the jurors was based on racial motivated reasons, and Commonwealth used the area in which two jurors had resided, one the age and one had resided in Petersburg, Virginia. Commonwealth said an individual residing in Petersburg, Virginia would be tolerant to drug use in that particular case, which I believe is analogous to what we have here today. The Commonwealth has stated that the two remaining jurors, Mr. Pratt and Ms. Taylor, living in high crime areas would be accustomed to violence, and this was a case involving a firearm possession by a violent felon. And that's analogous to what occurred there. We do agree that the Buck case was overturned for procedural reasons, but you know, we would like to ask the court to look to the persuasive authority of the dissent, and also to the initial Court of Appeals argument that using areas and geographical areas would just be a thin veil application of non-racial neutral reasons to get rid of African-American jurors.
Mr. McCall, why is this case not controlled by Tatiano out of this court?
I would say that Tatiano, that was the 1987 case, and right after Tatiano, we had the, if I'm not mistaken, we had the Bucks case, which really dwelled into the area, geographical area, in which was used as a simile for race. And so by that taking place after the 2011 case of Tatiano, we believe that the court still has freedom and room to apply a case-by-case scenario to the Batson approach.
Mr. McCall, this is Judge Beals. I'm not sure I follow your argument completely there, because while Tatiano was in 1987, and it was first, it decided differently, as Judge Decker noted, than this court did in Buck. And then this court in Buck was overturned by the Supreme Court. So why does that mean that we should not follow Tatiano? Because, as you said, I mean, the Supreme Court in Buck really decided it, overturned this court for, didn't indicate that we were wrong in Tatiano, and they certainly could have. And the dissent seemed to go the other way, but it was a dissent. So why does that mean we aren't bound by Tatiano?
I believe in Tatiano, the facts would be somewhat differently. In Tatiano, there was more of a direct correlation between where the jurors lived in regards to the particular offense. I believe in Tatiano, the actual jurors that were struck were stated to have lived in approximately a block or maybe a couple of blocks of the actual crime scene or incident scene, therefore showing that these individuals would have been used to seeing what had occurred there. Whereas in this particular case, in the Hartridge matter, we have a broad generalized statement of individuals that possibly live in high crime areas, areas that weren't specifically noted, areas that were not specifically related to this particular incident. There was nothing that tied those particular areas to any of the allegations in the Hartridge matter. So I do believe that that is a distinguishing factor from the Tatiano case versus the Hartridge matter.
Thank you.
And additionally, so what we would ask the court to do is to overturn the trial court's decision denying our Batson's challenge, additionally stating that in terms of pretextual motivation from the Commonwealth, the Hartridge has already stated that there was a systematic approach to striking African-American jurors. I do believe the Commonwealth may argue that there were other reasons why these particular jurors and African-American jurors were struck from the jury. But in terms of there may have been a failure to notice certain individuals raise their hands in regards to whether someone required DNA testing, fingerprints, scientific evidence. However, it's my understanding from the transcript, my understanding from trial, that the court had specifically laid out its reason, saying that the Commonwealth's reason for the strikes was based on high crime areas and pretty much did not concentrate on the DNA or the failure to raise hands. In fact, there was a point where the court says for all those reasons, the court is denying defense motion. However, that was directly after the court was even itself pondering and taking time to investigate and make inquiries into whether or why all of the African Americans had been struck, even the two individuals that the defense had already submitted to race neutral. There was an individual that may have been a part of the ACLU. Commonwealth went on to explain why that was important for that particular person to be struck by the Commonwealth strikes, and the court was simply responding to all of that after making an inquiry into all the reasons why all of the African Americans from the Commonwealth's preemptory strikes were used. Thank you.
Okay, counsel, you have about 4 minutes left for rebuttal after the Commonwealth's argument.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Shandoval?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Honor. May it please the Court, Chris Chandler for the Commonwealth in this appeal. As has been stated already, the only issue in this case is whether, under the third prong of Batson, the defendant has met his burden to prove that the prosecutor's strikes here were motivated by discriminatory intent. Now, the Supreme Court of the United States, on at least two occasions, and perhaps more, in Hernandez and also in Snyder, has said that this determination is a factual finding. And as a factual finding, it receives great deference on appeal because, per Batson, this determination is largely a credibility determination as to whether or not the prosecutor's reasons, race-neutral reasons, whether or not those reasons are indeed race-neutral or whether they belie some sort of discriminatory intent. As has already been stated, I think even this afternoon by the court, these credibility determinations necessarily receive great deference on appeal, as Batson noted, because these are inquiries that are specifically and peculiarly within the province of a trial court. Whether or not the prosecutor is credible as she explains her reasons for the strikes, and then also given the entire context of what has occurred, the conversations with the individual jurors, whether the trial court concludes based on what he or she has observed that those reasons are indeed credible and are sufficiently connected to the case to be tried in that particular day. So as the United States Supreme Court noted in Snyder, that it's only in exceptional circumstances that an appellate court will not defer to that trial court's credibility determination. And the Commonwealth would submit that this is not a case involving exceptional circumstances in which this court would need to overturn those credibility determinations. As has been argued, as we've argued on brief, the prosecutor cited two race-neutral reasons. First of all, that her primary reason was that she thought that she might have missed these jurors' hands when she asked whether or not they would require fingerprint or DNA evidence in order to convict the defendant. And, of course, the record demonstrates that at least seven of the potential jurors did raise their hands and were struck for cause on that basis. So the trial court would have been best positioned to determine, you know, whether there may have been other hands and whether it was credible to state that perhaps the prosecutor had missed those additional hands. And of course, on the cold record, it's I would submit impossible for this court to know whether or not, you know, how many hands were raised, how quickly, you know, where the potential jurors were positioned in the courtroom compared to where the prosecutor was positioned, and how likely it was that she indeed may have missed those hands, which gives even more reason for deference in this case. I would cite the court to Yarbrough versus Commonwealth, a case in which the prosecutor stated as one of her reasons that she was uncertain about some of the answers that one of the jurors had given to some of the questions raised, and this court in that case held that was sufficiently race neutral and did not belie a discriminatory intent, even though there was admitted uncertainty in that case. And even though in that case the court reporter actually read back the transcript and to indicate exactly what was stated on the record once the Batson challenge had been raised, and the prosecutor's response was, at the time, I was uncertain about what the answer was, and that's why I made that strike, and that was sufficient under this court's analysis in Yarbrough. And then, of course, I would, as I've argued, that reason was not challenged at trial as a legitimate reason to justify these strikes by Mr. Hartridge. And as the Supreme Court of Virginia held in Buck, and when they ultimately decided the case on procedural grounds, those procedural grounds were that the reasons given to the trial court for accusing the prosecutor of making race-based strikes, those reasons stated at trial were very general. And once they got to appeal, they became much more specific. But in Buck, the Supreme Court held that unless you make these specific arguments at trial to the trial judge, you can't turn around and make those same arguments on appeal. And that's why in Buck, the Supreme Court affirmed the trial court's decision. And I would submit that analysis controls this case in terms of the first reason that the prosecutor gave, because that was never objected to or challenged at trial. And that, in and of itself, is enough for this court to affirm the trial court's ultimate holding here. Secondly, of course, the high crimes area reason.
Mr. Chandeville, this is Judge. Mr. Chandeville, this is Judge Beals. I assume you didn't take issue with Mr. McCall's argument that when Judge Snuckles made her decision around page 88 or so of the joint appendix, when she said, "I think those are all valid reasons, and I will allow those." He said, "I would ask the court to note her objections," and she says, "not pretextual." But you're saying she's referring to the hands not being raised issue, or not knowing if the hands were raised of these two jurors, as well as the issue we've talked about more here, and that is the high crime aspect of the neighborhood.
Correct, Your Honor. I would submit the record establishes that comment that those are, quote, all valid reasons, comes at the conclusion of a discussion in which the prosecutor gave all of her reasons. So by finding that they were all valid reasons, that includes her reasons that they were in high crime areas, and also includes her reasoning that she may have missed her hands as to DNA evidence. And opposing counsel,
I mean, earlier on 85 of the appendix, Judge Snuckles seems to indict that, though, right? She says, "Is that a good enough reason for your failure to write something down? Is that a good enough reason to strike? I don't know. Is that a reason?"
And, yes, Your Honor.
And Ms. Lloyd says, "Any race-neutral reason." And the court says, "So the other people who were new, I knew they had not, and I knew that Ms. Brown had not," so forth. Do you think,
Your Honor,
at that point she's convinced, even though earlier she was not?
Yes, Your Honor, and I would cite the court to two cases in particular on that point, which are not cited on brief now that the issue has come up. The first is Mason versus Commonwealth, 64 VA App 292, specifically Penn site page 298, footnote 3, and also Bennett versus Commonwealth, 33 VA App 335. And what each of those cases stand for is this proposition that in Bennett, the court stated that this sort of judicial brainstorming from the bench during communication and argument by counsel is an integral part of our judicial system. And as this court noted in Mason versus Commonwealth, on appeal, appellate courts are not to kind of handpick various comments that the trial court may have made along the way in making its determination to undermine the trial court's ultimate conclusion. In this case, the trial court's ultimate conclusion was that those were all valid reasons. So based on Mason, I would encourage the court not to kind of seize on to this admitted skepticism initially when the argument was made, but I don't think that can undermine the ultimate conclusion, the ultimate factual finding that they were all valid reasons. So for that reason, the first reason given by the prosecutor in this case is sufficient to affirm the trial court's ultimate holding. And then, of course, ultimately, combined with the high crimes area as an additional reason, I would submit that there was more than enough to justify the trial court crediting the prosecutor's statements that these were her reasons and that they were not discriminatory. I would cite to Titano and assert that case is still good law. The Buck panel decision was decided after Titano, of course, but one panel, as this court knows, cannot overturn another panel's decision. Secondly, that panel decision was a divided panel decision. The dissent cited Titano. And then what opposing counsel has failed to note on brief or here in argument is that that case did not go directly from the panel decision to the Supreme Court of Virginia. It went first to an en banc decision, and this court en banc reversed the panel decision and held that the necessary deference that is accorded to trial courts in making this Batson determination control the outcome of that case. And as a result, the en banc panel was required to affirm the trial court's decision and reverse what the panel had done. Of course, that was rendered advisory by the Supreme Court of Virginia's decision, but I still think it further undercuts any reliance on the two judges who were in the majority in the Buck panel decision. And then finally, I would also submit that Titano is not distinguishable for the reasons that opposing counsel has posited. It's true that at least one or two of the jurors did live in the area of the crime scene. However, it is also true that two of the jurors simply lived in high crime areas. And the court in that case, which is, of course, exactly the case that we have here, that these jurors live in high-crime areas. And in that case, in Tantano, of course, the court held that that was a sufficiently race-neutral reason to not belie the discriminatory intent. And the same is true here. I would submit that we might have a different case. We would have a very different case if there had been anything in the record to indicate that these race-neutral reasons had been applied one way when it came to African-American jurors and a different way when it came to white jurors. We saw that, this court saw that in Hopkins versus Commonwealth and Brody versus Commonwealth, where the reasons given by the prosecutor were applied differently across the races. That would be the type of exceptional case where this court might overturn a trial court's credibility determination, a trial court's factual finding. This, of course, there's no evidence of that anywhere on the record. Opposing counsel has never insinuated that there was any such evidence on the record, and for that reason, the Commonwealth submits that the trial court's credibility determination was not clearly erroneous, and for all of these reasons, we would ask this court to affirm. Unless there are any further questions, I'm happy to rest on the remainder of my brief.
Mr. Chandevel, it's Judge Atlee. When you say the circuit court credited the Commonwealth for its arguments not being pretext, inherent and a big part of that is that this court, in the final analysis, found the Commonwealth attorney to be credible in her explanations and did not think that she was just kind of playing games.
Correct, Your
Honor. Is that a fair statement?
Correct, Your Honor. The ultimate decision in this case, typically when you have constitutional challenge, we normally see a kind of divided standard of review where there's deference given to factual findings and the ultimate conclusions or legal conclusions reviewed de novo. From very early, though, in this particular context of Batson challenges, the United States Supreme Court in Hernandez and in Snyder and implied as much in Batson has repeatedly held that the ultimate determination as to whether there is discriminatory intent is a factual finding, and it's treated just like any other factual finding in that it's entitled to great deference on appeal, and the reviewing court is required to apply a clearly erroneous standard. So, yes, the trial court's ultimate conclusion in this case, that all of her reasons were valid and that they were not pretextual, is a factual finding that is based on a credibility determination, and as a result, it's entitled to great deference here in this case.
Okay. Judges, any other questions for Mr. Chandevel?
No further questions for me.
Okay.
I'm
sorry, Judge Atlee, did you have...
No, ma'am, not from me either.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chandevel. And now, Mr. McCall, you have 4 minutes.
Thank you. Well, in terms of the deference does not imply abandonment or abdication of judicial review. It does not, by definition, preclude relief. You know, and that's something that was cited in the Hopkins case. Here, the Commonwealth laid out its reasons. The court was explicit, and it's shown on the appendix on page 86, line 20. Her reason for the strikes is the high crime neighborhoods. The notion that the Commonwealth's reason for the strikes dealt with the DNA and the Nazi hands raised was something that the court appears to not have considered when the court made its ultimate decision that the strikes from the Commonwealth were based on the high crime area. From there, the defense, Hartridge, did not waive any challenges to that particular notion stated by the Commonwealth. The Hartridge challenges the only notion that was accepted, and that was the high crime attempt to explain race-neutral strikes. So here again, Mr. Hartridge does challenge that they were not race-neutral and that they were a systematic approach to rid the jurors of African-American jurors. And we are asking that the court grant our motion and reverse the trial court's decision and remand this case for new trial. The trial court erred in its decision denying Mr. Hartridge's motion. Thank you.
Thank you. Judge Beals or Judge Atlee, do either of you have any questions?
It's Judge Beals. I don't have any further questions for Mr. McCall. but I thank him for his argument, Mr. Chandeville, as well.
Thank you, Judge.
I have no questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you both. The case will be submitted to the court now, and the court will reconvene for conference.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. You all have a good weekend.
Thank you, Your Honor. Have a great weekend. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel.